Welcome to another edition of Dark Matters Radio. Well, tonight I have a really great program coming at you. The gentleman I have on is a longtime friend, colleague, an award-winning reporter, television investigative journalist. He covers the beat of everything from the mafia to CIA to weird things that happen in the night in Las Vegas, Nevada. None other, of course. I could only be talking about one guy, Mr. George Knapp. George, as always, it's great having you here.
Great to hear your voice, Don. We miss you.
Well, I'll tell you, sometimes I would just prefer to be missed, George. Hey, look, how is your book coming? Now, for all you out there that haven't yet gotten it, read it, had chills go up and down your spine, the book, of course, I'm talking about is The Hunt for the Skinwalker, written by none other than George Knapp and Dr. Colin Kellner. George, how's that coming?
Well, it's doing really well. It came out at the end of 2005. It's had steady sales ever since. Every once in a while, we'll do a show like yours, and the sales spike. It's stayed in the top couple of thousand of Amazon.com. It's got a lot of attention. A lot of TV folks want to capitalize on it. We've had serious inquiries from movie folks, and it keeps plugging away. We still collect information, hope that maybe it might lead to a second book. I've been working on a documentary version of the book, actually, since before we started on the book itself, and that's pretty close to being completed. It's a fascinating story. It's disturbing, and as you know, and I don't know where it'll lead, but it's been one heck of a ride so far.
Well, you know, when the book first came out, my wife Vicki and I did a review on it. We both found it astounding. And as a matter of fact, I stated in there, in my review, that not since John Keel's initial release of The Mothman Prophecies has a book so disturbed me. And I meant that sincerely.
Well, I appreciate the review, and I really appreciate that comparison, because there's a lot of similarities. You know, what Keel had reported there in that Mothman thing was, similar in many ways to the phenomena on the ranch. I mean, totally bizarre, totally unexplained, doesn't fit into any neat category, and manifesting itself in so many different ways. And so I really appreciate the comparison.
Well, George, when is the last time that you've been out to that that ranch in Utah?
I was there in October, and I was there twice last year. But the last time was in October. Make periodic visits, continuing to work on the documentary, continuing to find new witnesses and new accounts of strange things that have been seen in that whole Uinta Basin area.
Is that still ongoing?
Well, I'm walking kind of a thin line here, Don, because, you know, when the book came out, the NIDS team, of course, was on the ranch for 7 years studying it intently. They sort of had a cone of silence over the property while their scientific study was underway, didn't want a lot of interlopers, didn't want a lot of attention for a couple of reasons. One is because there's a certain interactive quality of the phenomena. It interacts with different people in different ways, and they didn't want to upset the apple cart. Two is because the range of activity is so strange, non-reproducible. Nothing ever happened quite the same. They collected anecdotal evidence, some scientific evidence, trying to put together all of this material and come up with some sort of an explanation for what was causing it, and never did. I mean, it's just so unusual and out of the norm for anyone, for scientists or anyone. It's there's a UFO element to it, but it's not really a UFO story.
I was going to say it far exceeds something as simple, if I can say that, as a UFO connection.
Well, it sure does. I mean, not only the UFOs and strange UFOs at that, but also poltergeist type activity. Really weird activity like that, almost ghost-like stuff, specters, strange animals. It incorporates something approximating the Sasquatch legends. There have been cattle mutilations, violent episodes. It's been going on for hundreds of years. Then you add in Native American mysticism and things of that sort. There's no other place like it in the world. certainly not with this level of activity. So it's not, it doesn't fit into any niche, which is part of the problem. As we said when the book came out, you know, there's something in there for everyone to hate. As you know, perhaps better than anyone, Don, you know, the UFO people can't get along with themselves. That no one can agree on the basics, but they don't like the Bigfoot people. The Bigfoot people don't like them. None of them like the poltergeist people. None of these folks get along. So it's hard to get any kind of consensus, even in the paranormal field, let alone get any kind of consensus in the scientific community.
Well, quite frankly, George, it's very similar to dealing with a classroom full of kindergartners, you know? It's that bad.
Well, you're speaking of ufology now.
Well, I'm talking overall. Now, I'll give you an example, and I was going to mention this a little later in the show, but let me do it right now. About 3 weeks ago, after a very long period of silence from him, I got an email from Dr. Jack Sarfati.
Right.
Now, Sarfati is someone that has been around this field for a very long time. He has incidents, he claims, going back to his childhood in the early 1950s. And a few years ago, periodically, I would be in touch with him on various things. One thing that came up at one point involved Dr. Stephen Greer and his organization. And for whatever reason, Sarfati was on the warpath about that. And I had written something, and it was incorporated without my knowledge, actually, into something that he had written, and it was all over the net. But I had asked Sarfati several years ago to interview him, not only in the pages of UFO Magazine, but also on my radio show. At the time when I made this suggestion, he was busy, and he was up to something. I don't know what it was, but he couldn't do it. So you know how things are in life, George. Time goes on. I kind of forgot about it. It slipped my mind. And one day, out of the blue, I get this email from him, very angry sounding. And he says, basically, and I'm paraphrasing, when are you going to interview me so I can educate these stupid people that read your stupid magazine? So I just very slowly and methodically, I typed a message and I sent it back to him. I said, Jack, perhaps when you develop manners. And that was the last time I heard from him. Well, 3 weeks ago, I get on this mass list, and who's he talking to but none other than investigative journalist and award-winning reporter George Knapp about Bob Lazar, Area 51, and Element 115. Now, how were you graced with that?
Well, there's this email list. I think you probably are familiar with it, that Sarfati sort of presides over. A lot of really interesting people, scientists and folks who are really a lot of brilliant people who exchange ideas, some of it very heated exchanges.
Yes, Jack, I know.
Jack is very blunt and outspoken, as you know, and does not take any guff from anyone. Years ago, when I first heard of him, it was in connection with the Lazar story. He's a pretty harsh critic of the whole story, and he has his reasons for it. And so there were some exchanges where he was really blasting the whole thing, and I wrote back to him and expressed my viewpoint in my own way, and we sort of had it out. And I just figured, well, I'm washing my hands of this guy. I'm not going to talk to him anymore. It's a waste of time. And subsequently, I got on a couple of these email lists and then followed it, and I found him to be a really interesting character, you know. Has some interesting ideas. He obviously has a good mind. He knows most of the major personalities in the field, and I find him to be pretty entertaining. So we have a cordial internet online sort of relationship, strictly by email, but
it finally developed into being cordial, eh?
It is somewhat cordial. Now, the Lazar stuff came up. I forgot exactly how it came up, but I wrote something about it, and he took me to task again, but in a much more cordial way, giving me the benefit of the doubt of saying I'm a good guy, but I don't understand science. And he's right about that. I don't understand physics as well as he does, that's for sure. So we basically, it's similar to the relationship I have with Stan Friedman about the Lazar story. We agree to disagree and move on to something else.
Okay, George, hey, you know what? We're right up at the break time. Let me take a very quick break, and when we come back, more with my special guest this evening, award-winning television investigative journalist, Mr. George Knapp. All right, we are back with my guest, Mr. George Knapp. George, speaking of Bob Lazar, Element 115, Area 51, you are the man that put all those names on the world map. Back in 1988, when you broke your very first special, which encompassed Area 51, a mysterious purported scientist going under the pseudonym of Dennis, your life has had to take one hell of a whirlwind tour since then. What is happening with it?
That's put it mildly. Well, I've said before that's when I officially went crazy, when I started doing the Area 51 stories. You know, I honestly had very little interest in UFOs. I mean, the normal interest is like a regular person with an inquisitive mind, but had never done any work on it. And I approached it after I heard this stuff. I approached it like any other news story. You know, try to get facts that could be confirmed, interview the witnesses and the principal characters, look for videotape, follow a paper trail, and take it straight on in that way. Well, it's just, I've been vilified ever since. It started mostly with my journalism colleagues who, for some reason, just could not stand it. I think in part it was a little bit of jealousy because, as you mentioned, those stories hit like a tidal wave. I mean, the Area 51 material went all over the world in the flash of an eye. It generated so much attention regarding the base. Tens of thousands of people have come here to visit. Basically, every other major news organization in the world has made the trek out there. You got Area 51 rock bands and bars and merchandise and Bob Lazar Christmas ornaments and T-shirts. And it's an entire cottage industry, which I wish the heck I had a piece of it, Don.
Yeah, really, I'll bet you do.
And for me personally, I mean, you know, as you mentioned in the introduction, I do a lot of stories here. I've covered mob stuff and major political scandals and won a lot of awards. And in my hometown of Las Vegas, I'm considered a pretty solid reporter. But I'll tell you, everywhere I go, people talk to me about UFOs. I'm the UFO guy. And it'll probably be on my tombstone, the UFO guy.
The go-to guy.
the UFO reporter. I don't mind it. You know, I have enjoyed it every step of the way. I don't regret it for a second. It's probably caused me more grief than I had coming in journalism circles. I don't care because, the critics among my colleagues have been featured in three editorial cartoons in the state's largest newspaper in all kinds of columns where they've dubbed me a grand mullah in the Church of Cosmic Proctology. The radio DJs, when they run out of belch, barf, and fart jokes, they hit me for UFOs. They've written songs about it. I don't care. It doesn't matter because, we both know that 95% of the material in the field is nonsense, but it's that other 5% that's interesting and deserves serious scrutiny. We're talking about what could be the most profound development or phenomena in the history of mankind. And if we could confirm contact with something else, some other kind of intelligence, the world would be different.
Absolutely.
I regret chasing it as a story. I probably will continue it for the rest of my life. I know I've read some recent stuff that you personally are getting a little burnt out on it. I hope you'll reconsider.
Well, no. the short answer is no. But but be that as it may, something that I wanted to mention that is I think not known by many people, but your information flowing from that ultra top secret site known as in the popular vernacular as Area 51, you had other people come to you that never went public that allegedly worked out there, didn't you?
More than two dozen. If I had only had Bob Lazar, I'm not sure we could have done what we did. You know, Bob, his story was interesting. I found it to be credible. There were obviously some problems with parts of his story. I just never felt it deserved to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But in the course of after that first Dennis interview where we didn't reveal his identity, all kinds of other people came forward, and it's continued to this day.
Well, I'm sure you being the outstanding journalist and investigative reporter you are, you would have checked out whether they had bona fides or not.
Absolutely, and a lot of them are bona fide. What was most intriguing to me in those early days, around the time that we revealed who Bob was and his what his story was, other people came forward through various means and were harassed for it, one right after another, suggesting to me that somebody was listening to my phones for a while, because there were six right in a row who called to offer information, and they were visited within days by people purporting to be government agents who told them to keep their mouths shut. There was one woman who had worked as a secretary at a major defense contractor out at the test site. Holmes and Narver is the company, and she had sat in on meetings. Her story was relayed to a police officer I know, and he arranged to have a meeting with this woman. She was going to tell me her story, these meetings that she had sat in on where military officials speaking with government contractors discussing recovered alien technology. She had been a stenographer, I guess, in these meetings and took notes and was going to tell me about that material. We arranged a meeting. She got a visit from these two guys who came to her home and told her, look, we know you should realize that you are still under security coverage. You could be punished for spilling any secrets. And then they said, we know that you travel back and forth to L.A. to visit your daughter. We'd hate to have an accident happen to you or her out there. Well, she's frightened to death and still has not. I still periodically try to reach out to her. She's still too frightened to talk to me. There was another incident where an engineer who had worked at Area 51 had told me, this was a guy who I knew personally prior to the stories surfacing. He had told me that he had been out there in a hangar and had seen a disc covered by a tarp in this facility out there. I mean, a classic flying saucer. I arranged, I said, well, look, he lived in another city. I said, we could do an interview. I'll hide your identity. He said, fine, we'll do it. The day after that phone conversation, he wakes up, goes to work at a TV station in the city where he lived. There's two guys in a car outside his house. They follow him to work. They're talking into radios the whole time. When he gets out of work, they followed him home. He interpreted that as a message that he'd better watch what he said. There was a tax preparer who had worked with a lot of high-ranking officers at Nellis Air Force Base. His name was Roy Byram, and he said that in the course of getting to know all these officers out there, that he'd heard a lot of the stories about recovered technology. He calls me up, offered to give me an interview. 2 days later, he's visited by two guys who said that they were from the Secret Service, and they were investigating him for threatening the life of the president. He interpreted it as an attempt to keep him quiet. So there were six of those right in a row, boom, 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 which suggested to me that there was more to what was going on out there than just Bob Lazar making something up out of thin air.
Okay, so bottom line, George, today the planet ends. You're asked one question. Do you, in your heart of hearts, do you believe that there is recovered extraterrestrial technology out at the site?
I believe that there was. I don't believe it's there now anymore for the simple reason that since the stories broke, so many thousands of people have gone out there. So many news organizations have focused attention on it. Congressional investigations and investigators and personnel have been out there poking around about it. It wouldn't make sense for it to still be there unless they dug a hole and buried it or more likely transferred it somewhere else. But I believe that there was something like that out there for a period of time. It makes sense on a lot of levels, one being that if you had that kind of technology and you wanted to fiddle around with it and figure out how it worked, that would be the place where you'd do it. It was the perfect facility for it. That's the kind of thing it was built for. It's well known now, but few people before our stories, few people outside of Nevada had ever heard of the place. that would be the location of choice for testing and developing black projects. So it makes sense on that level.
Okay.
And two, it's just too many people have seen it. Too many, as I said, more than two dozen people who've come forward and given me bits and pieces of the story. We were not building this stuff. We were taking it apart to figure out how it worked. And I know it seems an outrageous story to tell, and it's very tough to prove, and I'm not sure we will ever prove it unless the government wants to open up the hangars and let us come in and kick the tires or something, which, you know, fat chance of that. But I believe that that is the case.
Okay, now we've got to go back to the very beginning of the story, Bob Lazar. Now, here's a guy that's an enigma wrapped up inside a riddle. Now, I've met Lazar on several occasions. I could never, in my wildest imagination, say I know the guy. I don't think anybody really knows that guy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
He's one of those people that kind of, and maybe through simple self-preservation, has had to hold the world off at arm's length. But be that as it may, here's a guy that came out allegedly spilling the cosmic beans. Now, you just went through a litany of people that have been threatened in every conceivable way to keep their mouths shut. But yet, Lazar is still going along his merry way. How in the world do we explain that?
Well, I think part of it is him coming forward. I mean, that was the argument that I made to him after I had first heard the story. You know, he was willing to do that interview as the shadowy Dennis character, but it took me months to talk him into going on camera and revealing who his true identity, who he really was. You can read all kinds of motives into that, but it wasn't something that here was a guy who was trying to cash in on this thing, who wanted a lot of attention. And you know, the story, unlike so many people in the UFO field, Bill Cooper, Dan Burrish, the story has stayed the same. You know, he doesn't have to elaborate on it. He had very little interest in UFOs before his employment out there. He wants nothing to do with the field since then. He doesn't go on lecture tours. He's not selling a book. They did put out a video at one point to explain the science of it, but it's not like the guy got rich on it. He wants nothing to do with it and isn't trying to cash in as so many people have done. The story has been consistent, and there are a lot of parts that, you know, critics and people like my friend Stan Friedman, who have pointed out weaknesses in the Lazar story, they are unwilling to accept the strengths of that story. One being Lazar's background, his employment background. There are some gaps there. You know, you can't prove that he actually worked at Area 51 to any substantial degree. But for me, the question was, did he really work at Los Alamos Lab? Because it conceivably, if he was there working in top secret projects, it could make sense that he could end up at Area 51. And as you know, we went to great lengths to try to prove that. The lab initially denied knowing anybody of that name. When I produced the newspaper article, front page from Los Alamos that showed that the story of his jet car that he had told the paper at the time that he was a physicist out there. And then I found his name in the lab phone book. Well, they changed their tune. Well, look, he might have been here as just for a brief period working for a subcontractor. We contacted that subcontractor, which is a headhunter firm, Kirkmeyer. They had initially told me that, yeah, we recruited Bob Lazar and to work out there. And I said, well, can I get the copy of the records? And they said, sure. And then for the next 2 years, we did this little dance where they wouldn't take my phone calls, wouldn't give me the records, wouldn't say anything, as if somebody had told them to keep quiet. I believe that Bob was there. I've talked to a lot of the people that worked with him. And it wasn't just as a simple technician at the super collider. He did other stuff. He took me there during the course of our investigation. We met Bob at Los Alamos. It was on a weekend, and he took us into the base. We took a television camera into the facility. He goes through the front gate and just kind of waves at these guys. They wave at him. He led us through a variety of different buildings on the facility, and running through this maze of offices and stuff like a rabbit through a burrow. He knew his way around. He'd see people there. Nobody tried to stop him. He'd say hi to this one and that. He'd been there. I mean, he really was there. So for me, that was beyond question. so that he did work there, and that meant that he could work at a place like Area 51. People forget that that Bob, before going public with this stuff, took other people out to Area 51 and told them when the test flights would take place.
Yes, I know.
All those people. They videotaped a couple of those tests back in the days when the black mailbox was not known anywhere outside of here, a small group of people. How did he know that the tests were going to take place? He passed a polygraph test, so we submitted to a couple of them. The first examiner conducted two tests, and he found them so nervous. Bob had some death threats that I know to be true, and did not do well. The guy didn't say he was deceptive. He just said he was so nervous that he couldn't really get a reading on it. So we went to a second examiner, a former police officer from down in your neck of the woods, named Terry Tavernetti, who was by that point had become a security director of a major corporation, a hotel casino corporation here in Nevada. He put him through the paces, and Bob passed. He passed the test. How did he do it? People like to pass on that. When Bob got into legal trouble involving a brothel here in town, the probation people thought he was portrayed him as some sort of a pimp kingpin,
yeah.
And they were advising that he go to prison, do some hard time. They were upset. The parole investigators were upset because they were unable to verify the claims of his background, his educational background, his employment history. Bob was sticking to his story. There he was, facing hard time. These people were mad at him, recommending hard time because they felt he was lying to them. If he were a con man, that was the time to come out and say so. But he didn't. He stuck to the story. And those investigators contacted a variety of agencies. They weren't told Bob Lazar's a liar, he's never been here. They were told instead, you don't have a need to know.
Well, George, the one thing about the Lazar story that has stuck with me for 15 years now anyway was back when he and his buddy Gene Huff, a real estate appraiser, were putting together the video that they ended up marketing on Lazar's story and the scientific proofs of his claims. They interviewed Dr. Ed Teller. Teller was questioned because Lazar, back in those days, and of course I'm not telling you anything, but I'm telling the audience, had claimed that he got the job at Area 51 because of a recommendation of Ed Teller. Ed Teller had put him in touch with the people at EG&G, which Lazar claimed had hired him. And when Teller was asked about Lazar, his reaction to that question, if he simply, and he didn't know he was being videotaped at the time, if he didn't know who Lazar was, he would have just said, well, who in the hell are you talking about?
Right.
But he didn't. He said, if you ask me that question, I will say nothing.
Yeah, it was a very strange...
That blew me away. That blew me away. Ed Teller, the man that developed the H-bomb.
It was a very strange reaction, and the reason they asked Teller is, by coincidence, I mentioned that Los Alamos Monitor newspaper story about Bob's jet car, in which he, on the front page, it said, yeah, I'm a physicist at Los Alamos. By coincidence, in that same edition of the paper, there's a notice about Edward Teller appearing at the lab. Bob's story is that he struck up a conversation with Teller, and that Teller had said, look, somewhere down the line, maybe I can help you out. And that's where that connection was first made. The interview with Teller, I think, was conducted by the program Hard Copy. And, they were interviewing about something else and let the camera run while they were asking about Lazar. And his reaction was so strange. I think that he makes a statement somewhere in the interview to the effect of, well, maybe I could have known him. Maybe I could have recommended it. And it is very weird, and it's just another little piece of the puzzle.
Are you still in touch with Lazar?
Sure, yeah. It's not every week. It's not even every month, but we stay in touch.
He's still doing contract work for the federal government, isn't he?
Well, I believe he still has a contract for Los Alamos. He makes low-level radiation detectors and has for a long time, and even though he was Bob the UFO guy, and all that attention was focused on him, he still maintained that contract for years afterwards.
That's amazing.
Now he has an online business where he sells scientific supplies and is doing real well and wants nothing to do with ufology, but trouble has a way of following Bob. As you know, he has long had an interest in fireworks and creating stuff like that, so he's been selling chemicals online, a variety of substances, including the substance that was used to kill that that Russian spy in the news a couple of months ago. And about a year ago, I guess, a whole task force of agents from different federal, state, and local agencies raided his house. They came in ninja gear and with machine guns and dragged Bob and his wife out and searched the place, trying to find evidence of him illegally selling dangerous substances.
All before his first cup of coffee, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, you know, Bob has, you know, the final chapter in his story, I don't believe, has been written. He's an interesting character, and I can just tell you this. I know a lot of people who don't know him think he made the whole thing up. I lived through that period. Don, you and Vicky saw a lot of it, but I was here every day. I know that the strange things happened, that there were break-ins of his home. People wouldn't take anything. They'd just leave all the doors open and write stuff on his blackboard. It was frightening. It was a frightening time, and people who didn't live through it can't understand it. But there are parts of his story that the critics just choose to ignore because they don't want to believe it. Well, I know there are weaknesses in the story as well that need to be addressed, but you have to address the whole picture. And I think Bob was telling the truth as he knows it. Doesn't necessarily mean it's the literal truth, because as he admits, they could have done things to his head. He was forced to drink some strange liquid, and there were intimidation tactics, and who knows what was really going on. But I believe him, that he's telling the truth as he knows it.
Well, George, as you just recently read in that paper that I had sent you, that was basically my take on the whole thing, that there are aspects of that story that are just simply too weird to be written off. And I never doubted that Lazar believed what he was saying. Now, I'm not saying I couldn't be fooled, but I believed that he believed it. Hey, look, we got to take another quick break. And when we come back, more with my guest this evening, Mr. George Knapp. We are back. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio on the Bohica. That's Bohica Radio Network. My guest this evening, award-winning news journalist, television journalist, investigative reporter, Mr. George Knapp. George, going back to the late 1980s when the Lazar story broke, there was one name that we did not mention yet that figured very, very prominently into this story. And it's a name that's legendary in its own right. And I'm talking about none other than John Lear, son of William Bill Lear, the stormy genius of Lear Sigler Corporation. Now, during those days, Lear was a pilot, and he has, I guess about a gazillion million hours in the air. He's flown all over the world. He worked for a CIA contract company back during the Vietnam War. I mean, this was a guy that brought to the table a lot of credentials, okay? Not only family credentials, corporate credentials because of his father, but credentials from the standpoint of being an action figure, if you will. Okay. Now, Lear, back in those days, came out with a very, very wild document today that's known collectively as the Lear Hypothesis. And I think most legitimate researchers in the UFO field would discount this probably on the face of it. But Lear was also very, very tightly connected to the Bob Lazar story. Did that hurt or help?
Probably ultimately hurt. You know, my first experience with John was he had helped our TV station do some stories about Area 51 and stealth technology before I ever knew him or before I was ever involved in UFOs. Some of our earliest reports about Area 51 dealt not with flying saucers, but about legitimate national security programs out there. And it was with Lear's help that we broke the first story about stealth being the F-117 out there. And so he had a certain amount of credibility with the station as a source. He came into the station one day, I think it was 1987, to speak to my mentor and friend, Ned Day, who was our managing editor and a muckraking journalist, a great reporter, and he pitched the UFO stuff. He showed Ned the MJ-12 documents, that might have been later, but a pile of documents showing government cover-up, and he might have even dropped the Lear hypothesis on Ned at that point. Ned wanted nothing to do with it. Says, thanks, John, for your help on other stuff, but we can't do this. Well, I had been eavesdropping, as always, and I stopped him before he left. I said, hey, let me take a look at that stuff. And I started reading it, and it was just blew my mind. I had never really paid any attention to the UFO field in a professional sense, but I thought, this is pretty interesting. At the time, I produced a little public affairs show called On the Record. It's a kind of show that airs in the middle of the night. It normally would focus on local politicians or issues. I decided to put John on, and he laid out his story, including the Lear hypothesis. And for a show that had a very little viewership at the time, it was an amazing reaction from the public. The phone was ringing off the hook, people wanting more information. I thought, wow, this is interesting. I had him on again. The reaction was even bigger. And I realized this issue somehow touches the pulse of the public in ways that I had never realized before. We had him on a third time with the infamous Bill Cooper, a moment that will live in infamy, at least in my professional career. I sort of regret that, but I think it was during that third program that he mentioned knowing somebody who actually worked at Area 51. That person turned out to be Bob Lazar. I know in the view of ufology and a lot of the critics of the story that they view Lear as the Svengali who created Lazar out of whole cloth or something, that he somehow manipulated this story. They misread that relationship entirely. Lear and Lazar hooked up almost by accident. Gene Huff, the real estate appraiser that we both know and Bob's friend, was up at Lear's house doing an appraisal, got into a conversation about UFOs, and Huff knew Lazar. He knew what was going on in his life. He sort of casually mentioned this to Lear. And they subsequently got together, and Lazar met with Lear. They talked about UFOs. At the time, Bob had nothing but disgust for the field, didn't think it was serious, didn't think it was worth talking about. But when he got hired at Area 51, suddenly Lear realized that this, this was his meal ticket in essence. I will say this, I owe John Lear a debt of gratitude, because when I first started working on UFOs, and the topic in general, he helped me a great deal. He had vast files, government documents that it would have taken me forever to collect that he allowed me to copy. It helped my learning curve, sped it up a great deal. I allowed him to basically tell his story how he wanted to tell it, asking him questions along the way. But I didn't treat him in a real critical way, just let him tell his story. I had trouble then with the scenario, aliens here to eat us and all that stuff. I suspect that there's probably a lot of good, solid information in the Lear document, sort of like the MJ-12 document. You know, there's a lot of legitimate, provable stuff in there, but he mixed in a lot of other things. Lear is a strange character. I remember him telling me one time that his motto was, my day is not complete until I've ruined somebody else's.
Yes.
He likes pulling people's chains, you know. He likes stirring things up. And maybe that was part of what he did with his documents.
I clashed with him.
Sure.
And it basically, and let me just tell this little story. I was, at the time, I was, quite honestly, George, I'll be very honest, I was glad I was in L.A. and that Lear was in Las Vegas. Because had I have been able to get to him, I'm afraid of what might have happened. But no, I'm telling you dead serious. He called up and then sent me I forget if it was a fax or an email. I seem to recall it was a fax. It's before email was really going around then. But apparently, this was around the time that I had done my first expose on Cooper. And Cooper had made the statement that I was a phony veteran, that I had never gone to Vietnam, had not been wounded, that I was making all this up.
words, that's for sure.
And Lear sent me this thing and said, I'm releasing this document and I'm giving you a chance to read it first. And I read that, and I got to tell you, I exploded. And I pulled out my records, and I immediately photocopied them and faxed them to him. And then I said, don't let me see you again, USOB. And he sent me back almost immediately an apologetic letter that he was sorry about this. But I knew where it came from. But I think, in hindsight, he was just seeing if he could get a reaction out of me, which is childish.
Childish, but it is John. I mean, it is John. There's no getting around that. He does things, I think, for effect, even though he may not believe it himself, you know, and I think that's a lot of what was in that Lear document. You'll recall that a couple of those conferences back when he was pretty hot, he would show up with bodyguards as if somebody was going to assassinate him.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a theatrical bent to him, that's for sure. He's an interesting character. I don't dislike him. I don't talk to him a whole lot, but you know, he certainly did bring a lot of attention to the field. However, those who suspect that Bob Lazar and his story are somehow a creation of John Lear have it completely wrong.
Oh, absolutely. And I've known that from, as a matter of fact, looking back now in retrospect, and you're bringing up actually some rather humorous memories for me, Lazar and Huff for a short while had a radio program that they did at your local radio station there.
Yeah, they bought the time and just kind of to goof off, you know, to have fun.
And they brought Lear on there and made fun of him on the air while he was sitting in the studio.
Well, they would do that to his face on a regular basis. You know, it was an interesting relationship. They, of course, did not take everything that he said seriously, did not take ufology in general seriously. And yeah, that you're exactly right. So, yeah, anybody who thinks that John Lear controlled Bob Lazar or Gene, they don't know what the heck they're talking
They don't know what they're talking about. Well, back in those days, actually, Las Vegas was an exciting place to be if you were speaking of saucers, the old Billy Goodman show, which was, he was the Art Bell before Art Bell was around.
Sure.
All over the western United States, he had a huge program.
That's true. And when Bob appeared on in that first interview as Dennis, it really got Goodman's attention. Those were the next media exercises that Bob went on. He went on that program a couple of times before his name was ever made public. And Billy Goodman had a whole cottage industry going there for a while. He had bus tours going out to Area 51, standing around at the black mailbox. A lot of folks thinking they're seeing flying saucers. When I went on a couple of those trips, and they weren't seeing flying saucers, but they all had a good time at it.
Well, people like Sean Morton used to take crowds out there. I guess everybody at $15 or $20 a head, and there would be 737s landing out at the test site coming in from Vegas. And look, there goes one. There goes one.
Yeah. They dubbed it Old Faithful. Yeah, it was Old Faithful. Showed up at the same time because that was a regular plane route.
Well, you know, there have been a number of other people in the Vegas area that have created a splash that you've done some stellar work on. Let me throw a name at you, George, and remember now you're on radio, so don't cuss.
Okay.
Dan Burrish.
Yeah. Well, where to begin? It was shortly after the Lazar stuff hit and all the attention was focused on Bob and on myself and on Area 51 that Dan Burrish, who then was Dan Crane, came out of the woodwork. I was invited to be a moderator of a panel that explored the possibility of extraterrestrial life, and there were some interesting people on there, including Dr. Dan Crane. The sponsor of the event was the Planetarium Society, which is something that he headed up at the time at the local community college, or the Young Astronauts or something like that, a position that he created for himself. And he had a publicist who it turned out was a public information officer at the time at Nellis Air Force Base, which is an interesting little tidbit to go along with this. Anyway, I show up for this event, and prior to the event, after it had been announced, I start getting anonymous mailers giving me information about the mysterious Dr. Dan Crane, The first one, I think, was from some person claiming to be his neighbor, who's a little old lady who said, gosh, you got to watch this guy. People come from the military in the middle of the night and get him, and he goes away, and it seems real mysterious. Now, how she assumed that it had something to do with flying saucers, I don't know. I suspect, I firmly believe, in fact, that Dan Crane or some of his friends were responsible for these mailings. I got letters and photos from some woman claiming to be his former girlfriend, showing him touring the biosphere. I got supposed documents smuggled out of Area 51 from his co-workers, including notes in which he's referring to me in derogatory terms, painting him as some sort of a shadowy guy who works with extraterrestrials. So then we show up at this event, and I was in the men's room at the time, and in he wanders and introduced himself, and I said, yeah, well, you know what, strangely enough, I've been getting some mailing about you out of nowhere, and he, like, turns white as a sheet. It might have been an act at the time, stormed out. The next day I get this letter from him explaining, I have never worked in extraterrestrial programs. I am not employed at Area 51. I can't say much further, and please don't bother me anymore. I mean, way off the charts for the brief conversation that we had. I didn't say anything of the sort to him. It struck me that this was some sort of an orchestrated campaign, and it's still going on. You know, we've gone back and forth at several junctures. I tried to find out, well, gosh, is this guy for real? You know, I was involved in the subject at the time. I was looking for corroborating witnesses, and I started looking into his background, and there's nothing there. You know, nothing could be proven. Well, over the years, he's painted himself as an MJ-12 operative. He claims to have had an ongoing friendship with an alien who was kept captive out at S4. He's borrowed bits and pieces from basically every major UFO conspiracy story that you can imagine and weaved it into this rich tapestry of folklore and mythology, creating himself as this world savior, secret agent, working to save the world from all kinds of evil forces. He's claimed that people are out to kill him.
George, what makes these morons tick?
Well, I think in his case and this small cabal around him, it gives meaning to their lives. These are people that don't have much of a life outside of these identities they've created for themselves. It gives them something to do, a sense of purpose. It makes them more important. And I think they have fun pulling it off on people. At this point in the Dan Crane story, I think they might actually believe this stuff. You know, they've gone.
Well, it's like the Jonathan Reed thing of several years ago that Art Bell was so instrumental in foisting on the American public, which was absolute crap from the get-go.
Yeah, and with the Burrish case, there, two things stand out for me. One is that there is nothing about his claimed life that he can prove to any degree that anyone would accept as proof. And two is everything that can be proven about him shows that he is not the person he claims to be. For example, he was a parole officer for a while. I have his employment records. I tracked him down. I talked to some of his coworkers. It was a real job. He reported there every day. At that time period, when he was a full-time parole officer here, he claims that he also was employed as the scientist out at Area 51, where he not only became friends with the alien, J-Rod, but he also encountered angels, cherubim, and he spoke to them in ancient Aramaic and things of that sort. I mean, just adding all kinds of nonsense. But at the time that he was employed full-time as a parole officer, his subsequent resume says that that's when he earned his PhD from New York University at Stony Brook. Well, how do you have a full-time job in Las Vegas and you're getting a degree in Stony Brook? When I pointed out the inconsistency, then he came up with the story that the secret government was flying him to New York on weekends to earn his PhD. Well, this is anybody who's ever earned a PhD in anything. This is an insult to them that you can fly. A, that it's preposterous that the government flies you there on weekends. B, the school has no record of him being there. And C, he was here full time at the time. But that doesn't stop Crane, Burrish, or any of his supporters.
Well, now let me, as a matter of fact, before I do that, we're going to have to take our last break. So let me put this on hold for just a second, George. Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Dark Matters Radio on the Bohica Radio Network. My guest this evening, Mr. George Knapp, award-winning television investigative journalist, Las Vegas, Nevada, the face when somebody turns on KLAS television. There it is, George Knapp. George, you've been there for a long time, haven't you?
Seems like forever, but well, it's a great job. I live in the best news town in America. I work for the best news organization here, and I have the best job. I mean, I get to work on whatever I want, and there's never a slow news day here.
Well, man, if you love your job, what more can you say?
That's
damn near as good as a great marriage. George, we were talking about Dan Burrish right before we had to stop for the break. And now I'm going to get into something that's really unpleasant for somebody that's been doing UFO investigation as long as I have, writing about it, journalism. You know, I first encountered Linda Howe. Now, not personally, but her work when I was living in Denver circa 1980-81. And she did her award-winning documentary, Strange Harvest. And I'm sure everybody in the UFO or that has an interest in UFOs is familiar with that. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It was a great piece of work.
Well, in recent years, I really have got to question what has happened to Linda's investigative skills. Now, talking about Dan Burrish, somebody that we covered in the pages of UFO Magazine, let us just be very polite and say that we found nothing to support anything that Dan Burrish was saying. You've done your work on him, even more so than what we've done. I mean, you've gone to great depths and you found nothing, but yet somebody like Linda Howe, who's been around this field forever, I mean, forever, and she accepts what this guy says. As a matter of fact, I heard her say, if memory serves me, on the George Norrie show, well, why do I have to check him out? He's so believable. Or words to that effect. Now, how in hell do you justify that?
Well, I don't, and Linda's a friend of mine, and work with her a lot over the years, and she's done some really great stuff. It could be that maybe she spread herself a little too thin, because this is the kind of story, considering that the claims are so outrageous. If they were true, they'd be profound, of course. But for something like that, you'd want to do the basic legwork to find out if there's any kind of a paper trail to prove it. Now, in Dan's case, it's just not there. And worse than it not being there is that, as I said, everything that can be proven about the guy proves that he's not telling the truth. He worked as a security guard in casinos. He had a hard time hanging on to those jobs, doesn't do anything, and he's gone to great lengths to create a false trail to establish credentials, things like putting his class ring on his website to prove that he got a degree in biology that he does not have. As if the people who sell class rings do background checks.
Now, didn't he at one point claim that he found a cure for cancer?
Yeah, that was while he was an undergraduate student in biology at the university, and he claimed to have a cure for cancer, and he called a news conference at the school without permission from his professors, which, of course, they went through the roof over it, you know. He's a guy who likes attention, although he pretends to be humble and doesn't want attention. And so that, you know, that sort of set the tone for him. But he'll do, there's a website, the Naval Foundation, that it's a social organization. It has nothing to do with the Navy. Anybody who pays $25 can get listed there. They don't do background checks. They have a staff of two or three people. There are thousands of people who have joined a fraternal sort of organization. Well, Crane puts his photo, claims to be a captain in the U.S. Marines. and puts that on his website as proof that he was in the military, which, of course, you know, that story goes back and forth whether he is or is not in the military.
Very simple to check out.
Yeah, well, there is no proof. He's never in the military. And to suggest that this guy, if you've ever seen him, that he is a U.S. Marine, I would think there'd be a lot of leathernecks out there. Jarheads would be pretty ticked off about it. He would, you know, there's a whole litany of things. He's released these photos showing himself arriving at a secret location outside Nevada, Las Vegas, Sunrise Mountain, where he has a driver who's also wearing a uniform and opens the door for him and salutes him. Well, you know, he alerted the people, his friends, that they were going to be out there. They staged this little drama. The driver is his wife. And people buy this stuff. Every time there's an event around the world, he ties himself into it. He claims to have gone to the Iraq War, the first Gulf War, where he saved the world from biological terrorism. When Hurricane Katrina hit, he claimed that he was involved in a secret project to clean up the ocean before pollution destroyed the Gulf. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. The lengths they have gone to create this mythology, it's ridiculous.
Oh, Lord. You know, this is another reason why I've just basically decided to bail. Well, you know, it's now let's talk about overall here, the last few minutes that we have. The overall field, it's been abysmal, in my opinion, George, for years now. What do you think about that?
I can't disagree. I mean, you know, the most basic level, the most basic question is, are we any closer to answering any of the big questions after 50, 60 years of the modern UFO era? And the answer is no. We don't know what this intelligence is. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know what its motives are, why it's here. We don't know if it's interdimensional or extraterrestrial. We don't know squat. The best, supposedly the most important case, the Roswell crash. Good gosh, you got all these people who spend decades trying to research this thing. They can't agree if there was one crash or two, whether there were bodies, what the locations of the crash was. There's disagreement about the dates. You know, you have so much infighting and jealousy and turf battles, and then you have the wacko factor. You have the conspiracy nuts. You have the hopelessly gullible saucer crazy people who will believe anything that they see in the sky is from Zeta Reticuli. You have people with religious overtones. You have people, you know, like Bill Cooper, who want to paint the whole thing as a big conspiracy. You have blatant profiteers who just want to make money. They'll sell anything. They'll say anything. It brings great discredit to the field. It's no wonder that mainstream science and mainstream journalism don't take it seriously. And I agree with you. It's disgusting at times. I regret to hear, Don, that you're getting out of the field, because it sure needs people like you and Vicky in it. That magazine has been a beacon for so long, one of the only sources of reliable information for a long time. I've had similar thoughts that maybe it's just not worth my time, but the bottom line is that, you know, the questions involved are so profound and important, and it needs people to go after it, and it needs people to take it seriously. So I hope someday you decide to reconsider, even though we both agree that this field is completely whack.
Well, you know, I'm still going to be touching upon the subjects on the radio, but as far as getting out in the field and doing much with it now, George, quite frankly, it's very problematical. Well, look, we are just about out of time. I want to thank you for coming on. This has been a great, great hour, George. As always, it's fantastic talking to you. Hey, for all those folks out there that have not yet read Hunt for the Skinwalker by George Knapp and Dr. Cullen Kelliner, how can they find that book, George?
We have a website, huntfortheskinwalker.com. You can log on to that, and there are ways you can buy it through Amazon or a couple of the other online services. It's been tough to keep it in stores. We've sold a lot of copies, but, you know, the bookstores just don't stock a lot of them, so folks have a hard time, but you can always get it online.
Do you ever have a book signing?
I had one or two here, but it's still, you know, we still haven't cracked the general population. I hope that's still possible. Well, but if you want to arrange one, I'll come down there to L.A. and you and Vicki and I will go to dinner.
Boy, that'd be great. That would really be great. And speaking of, the last time we saw you in Las Vegas and we had dinner, I asked you a question about the possibility of at some point being able to go out and do a little rooting around that ranch in Utah. You said you'd see. Boy, I hate to put you on the spot like that.
It's still a question mark. I mean, I don't have the ability to let you.
Well, I understand that.
But it's still a question mark. In fact, I have a phone call in right now to the guy who could answer that question for us.
Well, that's one place, George, that if I could get to it, boy, I would chew 10 penny spikes and spit out thumbtacks to get out there.
If I can pull it off, Don, you'd be the guy to go with me.
Okay. Well, George, that is it, my friend. Thank you so much. And, allow me to extend the invitation to come back soon.
I appreciate that. Always great to talk to you. Say hi to the little woman.
Okay, will do. Okay, that is it for this edition of Dark Matters Radio. Hey, you guys, gals, everybody are listening to the Bohica Radio Network. Till next time, keep looking up.